Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the IB Green Minds podcast. My name is Phoebe Scott, and this week I'm joined by Deirdre Cooper. Deirdre is co-head of thematic equity within the multi-asset team at 91, formerly Investec, and she's also the co-portfolio manager for the Global Environment Fund. Prior to 91, Deirdre was a partner, portfolio manager, and head of research at Ecofin. And before Ecofin, Deirdre was an investment banker at Morgan Stanley, where she headed their European renewable energy coverage effort. She has also worked on a voluntary basis in the microfinance sector, both in the US and in Pakistan. Deirdre, thank you so much for joining us today on the Green Minds podcast.
Really a pleasure, Phoebe.
And I thought it'd be great to start off by talking about your career to date. How do you think that the investing world, and particularly the concept of sustainable investing, has changed since you started your professional career over 20 years ago?
You know, it's really quite extraordinary, both the amount of change and also the pace and how much that has accelerated, I think, in just the last, 18 months or so. So as you mentioned, I started at Morgan Stanley, initially in the general M&A team at Morgan Stanley. I then went to business school, and around that time, really felt that I wanted to work in an area that was more aligned with my personal beliefs, where I felt in some small way I could have a positive contribution. I had a very undefined idea as to what that might be. As you mentioned in the intro, I spent some time working in the microfinance industry, which I was really fascinated by. I went back to Morgan Stanley, worked for the late Sir Jeremy Haywood in trying to think about building a sustainable finance business, which was an amazing experience working under just an incredible man who then went on, of course, to become the cabinet secretary under many subsequent prime ministers. And at that point, sort of nurtured by Jeremy, I started the Clean Tech Investment Banking Group at Morgan Stanley in 2006. And then moved relatively quickly the following year to Ecofin, which was a client of mine. So Ecofin was a specialist investor in energy and utilities, and I was focused on investing initially in private equity within the clean tech sector. And then in 2009, started to think about listed long only and long short, and ran for 10 years a mandate in listed equities in the environment sector for the Norwegian Sovereign Fund. And then in 2018, I moved to 91, where I am now. I'd gotten to know the team over the years here, who really had a very interesting evolution from being traditional energy investors who were super early in understanding the shape of the transition and allocating capital proactively from an energy fund to companies that were helping to drive decarbonization. So I've been here now for about 2.5 years. And as I said, have just been amazed how, when I started doing this in 2006, this was just very, very niche. I think over the last 5 years, we've seen a huge increase in the number of investors thinking about climate risk, thinking about decarbonization as an opportunity, but not necessarily allocating capital in that direction. What I think has really changed, as I said, in just the last 12 or 18 months, is the number of people who are actively making decisions within their portfolios in order to both address climate risk and positively allocate to those companies that are helping to solve the problem.
Thank you so much. That was really insightful. And as you mentioned, I think particularly recently with the COVID-19 pandemic has definitely accelerated some of the trends you mentioned in the topic of building back greener, which is really interesting. I'm sure you've picked up on as well. Just turning to your current role, as you mentioned, as the co-portfolio manager of the Global Environment Fund, just be interested to find out a bit about the fund and why it was set up and what its ethos is.
Absolutely. So as I said, I worked for a long time thinking about investing in listed equities in those companies that have products and services that help to solve decarbonization, and came together with the rest of the team at 91 thinking about exactly the same problem. So we worked really hard to design a strategy that very specifically addressed that challenge. And in order to do that, we spent a lot of work both across the team, but also working with an external carbon data provider. We screened global equities using fix Bloomberg industry classifications and then using a methodology to calculate the carbon avoided from their products. And that gets us our investment universe, which is, you know, a much bigger investment universe than many people would have expected in the sector. So it's over 700 companies. It's over 6 trillion in market cap. And we think it's really important, you know, to allocate capital to those companies. As you probably know, in order to address climate change, we as a planet need to invest on an annual basis somewhere between $2 and $4 trillion. And where we are today is we're investing around $500 billion. So a tiny fraction of the required amount. I think to get from that $500 billion all the way to $2 to $4 trillion, you know, private equity plays a really important part because primary direct investment is so impactful. But the largest pieces of the $500 billion being invested today come from companies. That's about $182 billion and sovereigns. So it's really important not to neglect that part of an asset owner's asset allocation, to think about their listed equities, think about their sovereigns, and proactively allocate capital to those companies who are helping to solve this problem and to engage with those that are not moving quickly enough. And some of them may be those companies that are solving the problem, but not just not doing quite enough, to encourage them to increase their investments in order to have that transition happen as quickly as it needs to, which, of course, is not the case today.
Thank you. That's really interesting. As you mentioned, obviously, decarbonisation is a big theme of the fund. And there's also the term structural growth, which has been mentioned a lot in association with the fund. And I was wondering, why is structural growth so important to the ethos of the fund and what you're trying to achieve?
It's absolutely core, and it goes hand in hand with decarbonisation. So the structural growth is not something we look at alongside decarbonization. Decarbonization is a driver of the structural growth for the companies within the strategy. So from an impact perspective, we want to allocate capital to companies who have products and services that are helping to solve climate change. And then from an alpha perspective, from our ability to outperform global equities and thereby provide a good return stream to our ultimate investors, we think that if we allocate capital to those companies, because the world is moving towards that 2-degree scenario, not quickly enough, but absolutely moving in that direction. And there's been a number of events this year that have sort of helped push us in that direction. We think those companies will see a structural growth well above and beyond, you know, global GDP, well above and beyond the growth experienced by the average company in the market. And that therefore means those companies over the long term, if we can find those that have really good competitive advantages and turn that growth into good returns, that those companies should outperform global equities. And that's definitely what we've seen, you know, since inception.
That's really insightful. You mentioned the screening process for the companies, and you mentioned over 700 companies in the universe. You briefly touched on the methodology for doing this. From my research, it seems that you have a proprietary methodology for analysing indirect scope 3 emissions, which is quite a niche, precise term for someone who might not be familiar with the topic. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to explain what these indirect scope 3 emissions are for our listeners and how this works?
Absolutely. You know, as I've been doing environmental investing for a long time, I think probably as long as 7 or 8 years ago, some early investors started to think about the carbon footprint of their investments. And that's something that many people, even, you know, retail investors today, will want to know what the carbon footprint is of their portfolio. And the problem is, once you start to look into it, it's not a simple question to answer in terms of calculating the carbon footprint of an investment portfolio. So what you do is you first of all think about the company's direct emissions, which are called scope 1 emissions. So those are the emissions from anything the company owns that has a chimney or a tailpipe. So think about factories, power plants. If you own company cars, if you own a corporate jet, or if you're an airline that owns airplanes, then all of those are scope 1 emissions. And of course, if we add up all the scope 1 emissions, then we get the total emissions of the market. But when you want to think about the climate risk of a business, just knowing its direct emissions doesn't really tell you a lot. So if there was a big global carbon price, you wouldn't just want to know about the factories that have chimneys and what comes out of those chimneys. You'd want to know about the sources of power and the gas that goes into those factories. Because although the emissions don't happen in your facilities, you will end up having to pay for the carbon price because it's a big supply to you. So that's scope 2 emissions, which is purchased electricity and gas. But then you think about the world we're in today, which is an increasingly global and complex set of supply chains. So if you take an example, take Apple versus Samsung. So Apple is actually mostly a manufacturing and design company. They don't actually make the phones. Samsung is an extremely vertically integrated company. So not only do they manufacture the phones, they manufacture the screens, they manufacture the semiconductors that go into them. In fact, Samsung supply the OLED screens and the memory chips that go into Apple's iPhones. So if you were to look just on a scope one and two emissions, then it would tell you that Apple is a really carbon-like business. It doesn't have any kind of climate issue. And Samsung is a really carbon-intensive company because they manufacture. But of course, if the carbon price means that the cost of Samsung's manufacturing goes up, then that's going to hit Apple just as it hit Samsung. The phones don't have dissimilar carbon footprints. So that is the first eight categories of scope three, the upstream emissions, the emissions from your supply chain, you know, from the capital expenditure that goes into that, all of those indirect emissions within your products. And it's really important to understand these because, as I just illustrated, those emissions are just as important for your climate risk as your scope one and two emissions. And then you get to the other eight categories of scope three, which are the downstream emissions, the emissions from your products and services once they're used. And here again, it's important to understand these because these are really important for climate risk. And the best example when you want to think about downstream emissions is to think about a pure play coal miner. So actually, when you take the coal out of the ground, it's not particularly carbon intensive. There will be some emissions from the generators that are used on site. If you own the diggers, they will have emissions, but it's not very significant. Where the really significant emissions happen is when the coal goes into a power plant and it's burned. The coal miner normally doesn't own the power plants, the utility does. So a pure play coal miner doesn't always have a very high carbon footprint. It's its customers that do. But of course, we know that as we transition, it's very, very hard to see a role longer term for a pure play coal miner. The same is true for any large energy company or mining company. You know, 95%+ of their emissions will be downstream scope three emissions. The problem is that their products in a 2-degree world, you know, there's a much smaller end market for those products. The same with the auto industry. It's not making the cars that's carbon intensive, it's driving them. The car companies don't own the cars for the whole life. Their customers do. But as their cars are regulated away, as the governments say you'll have to sell more electric cars and less combustion engines, then that is a really important source of climate risk for that business.
Thank you. Some fascinating insights there. Would you say that as carbon reporting becomes more integrated and a necessity, as opposed to something nice for investors to have, double counting might be an issue in terms of one firm's scope one is another firm's scope three? Or would you say that full disclosure is needed for both?
So we really believe that full disclosure is needed for all three categories. So yes, double counting is a problem, but ultimately what we're trying to get at when we footprint investment portfolios, and this is a really important point, is not the perfect answer in terms of what are the emissions of the market. What we want to get at is where do you have climate risk and how can that affect long-term returns for your stakeholders, whether those are pension fund, you know, retirees, whether they're savers, whether it's a sovereign fund or a large university endowment, for example, which is why, you know, fussing about double counting is sort of irrelevant. What you want to do is you want to find those businesses that have a lot of climate risk and ensure that you understand that risk and also that you engage with those companies such that they can adjust their business models to become more sustainable. And of course, that's easier for some industries rather than others. We see the auto industry very much in transition, you know, with companies really moving to make electric cars. We see the oil industry, you know, as an example, probably a little bit slower. You know, you're still at a stage, I think this year that's starting to change, but, you know, certainly if you look back, you're still at a stage where less than 10% of CapEx across the industry was invested in decarbonization solutions as opposed to traditional oil and gas. But you're never going to find that out unless you look across the supply chain. So then at a portfolio level, to take into account those double counting issues, you really need to compare companies to others in their sector, to look at intensity metrics, to look at your emissions as a percentage of the market cap or as a percentage of the revenues in order to solve for that double counting problem.
Just touching on the fund as a whole again, you won Environmental Fund of the Year in 2020, and it would be great to talk about what you think the fund's key success factors are.
I think it was a couple of things. I think we've had very strong performance because ultimately, and we really believe this at the core of all of our sustainability strategies at 91, they are run by people who genuinely believe that the work they do on sustainability is core to their ability to generate returns. That over the long term, companies that are more sustainable will outperform. And I think that's very important to make that distinction, which is the sustainability research and the financial research are absolutely aligned. And nowhere, I think, is that clearer than in the decarbonization sector. Some of the other things we've done on the environment strategy that I think have been well appreciated is we have absolute transparency. So in our impact report, we write about, you know, not just the couple of great things that are happening at some of the companies we hold, we also write about the things that are less good. So we disclose the emissions and the carbon avoided for every single company. And we talk about the ones that are moving really quickly and reducing their emissions and growing their carbon avoided and the ones that are just a little bit slower. And there always will be some that are faster than others. And then we monitor what percentage every year are decarbonizing and are growing their carbon avoided. It's not 100%. It's last year about 63% reduced their emissions and about 83% grew their carbon avoided. And then we discuss the companies that aren't doing quite so well and explain what we're doing with those companies. We also talk about our other engagements because, of course, we think not just about E or environment. We think about the social and the governance as well. And, you know, we hold a number of companies where they're not as diverse as we'd want them to be. Probably the board isn't as independent. The labor practices are not as progressive as you might prefer. And all of those are important topics. And then I think the final element that for us is very important when we think about sustainable investing is a fundamental overlay. So our view is that there are problems with data, and you mentioned we work with a proprietary data set to help us find those carbon avoided companies. We really believe that that data is helpful, but that ultimately to really understand sustainability, you have to understand data in the context of the company's business model and its culture. So the data alone will never tell you if a company is sustainable. You need a deep fundamental process in order to get there. You can't do ESG by numbers. The numbers really help you to provide measurement, to provide information to your investors, to check your assumptions. But that has to go hand in hand with the fundamental process and particularly with that focus on culture.
Thank you. As you mentioned, that it's a mixture of quantitative analysis and qualitative on the culture side as well, which is really interesting. Broadening out a bit to thinking about other factors which might be relevant when you're doing your assessments. ESG ratings are becoming increasingly common for listed companies. Do you think that these are a useful metric for PMs?
Absolutely. So we use a number of different ESG data providers at 91. We look at MSCI research. We look at Refinitiv data. We use a small data provider called Urgentum that helps us with our carbon data. We use ISS to help us assess voting. And all of those are useful, just like we read sell-side research from Goldman Sachs and from Morgan Stanley and from UBS and from a whole variety of different providers. What we would say is that to rely solely on an external ESG rating as your sustainability research would be extraordinary, just like it would be extraordinary to say that your entire investment process was based on understanding one particular bank's sell-side research approach. You know, no one would ever do that. So I think it's important to understand the difference between an ESG rating as a sort of ultimate arbiter, because we will often disagree with the rating provider, and using the information that they provide, the views that they provide, to help inform your process, and then to take that and do that in-depth fundamental research I talked about.
Thank you. So you wouldn't say that the field is too fragmented to limit its utility to you?
I think on the ESG ratings providers, you know, the more the merrier in some ways. We need a diversity of views. I think in terms of ESG data reporting, so the sort of commonly named alphabet soup of groups like the GRI or the SASB or CDP on carbon, I think having coordinated ESG data from companies would be very helpful. There's no question. I mean, I think our view is that ultimately where we need to get to is integrated profit and loss. So what we're doing with carbon avoided is effectively quantifying an externality. In this case, for these companies, it's a positive externality on the carbon avoided, but there's always a negative externality on their carbon footprint. And that's just one externality within the natural capital grouping. I think over the long term, you know, you need to think about your water externality, your natural capital and biodiversity externality. On human capital, you need to think about how companies are providing value to their employees. Are they training them? Are they allowing them to grow their careers? We need to think about social impact. You know, there's some companies that will have a very positive impact on society through providing healthcare services or education, but it's not the case that every healthcare company and education company has positive externalities. So to really provide that integrated profit and loss, I think, is ultimately where we need to get to over the very long term. And at that point, you know, we start to move away from ESG ratings. Doesn't mean that the ESG reports that are written by some of those rating providers aren't still helpful, because they'll give you context around those externalities, just like the sell side give you context around the financial reports. But to develop fully integrated profit and loss, I think, is where the world needs to go.
Thank you. That's a fascinating concept. As you mentioned, to internalize these externalities is where companies need to go. And slightly switching topics, focusing on another sub-theme of the fund, as you mentioned, renewable energy, which has been in the headlines a lot recently, for example, with the UK and wind power. I was wondering if there were any key emerging trends that you have noticed in the renewable energy sector recently.
So I think the biggest one by far in that sector is just one word: acceleration. So in Europe, you know, you have had this year the European Green Deal, the stimulus package for Europe, 750 billion euros, of which about 38% is dedicated to climate. And a lot of that will be the build out of clean electricity grids. If you go to North America, who knows when we have runoff elections in Georgia, what the Senate looks like. But I think it's fair to say there's an acceleration in climate policy in the US. Having said that, the last 4 years under the Trump administration have been the best 4 years in history for renewables in North America. And because of cost, because there's been such huge technological progress that if you are a utility choosing to build a power plant, you will always choose wind and solar, or you will most likely choose wind and solar, because those are by far and away the cheapest option. And you have an obligation, your regulator has an obligation to provide the least cost resource. Then moving into Asia, I think China is probably the most interesting region to look at, and the one that potentially is on the cusp of the most fundamental change. So on the 23rd of September this year, Xi Jinping gave a speech at the UN in New York and targeted net zero in China by 2060, which is a huge change. China historically has been focused on limiting the emissions intensity of GDP, but has been very careful not to set an absolute net zero target. So that's a very big deal. China is by far and away the world's largest emitter. About 28% of global carbon emissions are from China, less than 15% are from North America. And China's still building coal-fired power plants. So I think China's building about the last couple of years, 30 or 40 gigawatts a year. If you put that in context, the entire UK electricity grid's about 60 gigawatts. So it is just enormous. China also builds more renewable energy than any other country in the world by a factor of more than two. But that doesn't even meet their incremental power demand growth. If you really move to decarbonization, then the opportunity set for renewable energy growth in China is just phenomenal. And it looks as if, you know, we certainly don't have all the detail, that China is potentially at a tipping point in terms of climate policy, where you do move towards a decarbonization scenario.
Thank you. And you mentioned cost there. How important would you say that government subsidies are in shifting focus towards renewables as opposed to traditional energy sources?
That has really changed when you think about renewable energy to generate electricity. So where we are now, as I said, is if you were deciding in the US, you know, what kind of power to build, your combined cycle gas turbine is going to come in somewhere between $40 and $50 a megawatt hour, even with gas prices in the US that are at levels that no one ever thought, you know, would be possible. Gas had been double digits. You're now looking at $2 or so. But a wind farm will come in with the tax credit in the mid-teens. Absent the tax credit, you're probably in the low 20s. A solar farm is probably in the mid to high 20s with the tax credit, but in a couple of years will easily hit that price point without the tax credit. You know, in that case, you're not looking for subsidies. What you are looking for is regulatory visibility. And Europe, you know, the situation in Europe is exactly the same. But that doesn't mean that governments don't have a really important role to play, because ultimately, generally speaking, the electricity grids is a regulated industry. It may have a market-based system like the UK, which is a merchant power market, but ultimately Ofgem in the UK plays a really important role in regulating that market and in putting in place policies that are amenable for renewable development. And of course, the long-term policy visibility is much more important for renewable energy than it is for traditional fossil, because renewable energy is all capex, no opex. You need to spend money on your wind farm or your solar farm, and then you get paid over 20 years. Whereas if you look at fossil, yes, there's capex in the plant, but there's also ongoing resource cost. And therefore, you know, you get your money back more quickly. So if you're going to invest for a 20 or 30 year lifetime, you really need to know that the regulatory system is visible, that you can depend on it. And that's why governments continue to play an extremely important role. And then, of course, in earlier stage technologies, you know, as we think about not just decarbonizing 60% of the electricity mix or even 70, but getting to that 80 or 100%, then batteries, then hydrogen potentially plays a role. And those are sectors where you do need regulatory support, particularly, you know, for hydrogen.
Thank you. As you mentioned, it's clearly a very fast moving field and one that we should all be keeping an eye on. Just slightly moving away from renewables to the topic of transition finance, as opposed to solely financing green energy. What are your thoughts on this area?
So I think there is a bit of a kind of semantics question. You know, people complain in Europe, for example, that the EU green taxonomy, that we need a brown taxonomy, a transition taxonomy. I would consider the EU taxonomy to be a transition taxonomy. So, you know, they highlight sectors such as cement, steel, where there's an opportunity to decarbonize, and then you get credit if you can find technologies within those carbon intensive sectors that are hitting a certain emissions requirement. So I think transition financing is sometimes misused to consider financing natural gas, for example, where it's very hard to see a long-term role in a two-degree scenario. I don't think if you really understand that two-degree scenario, particularly as hydrogen technology improves, that you would invest in natural gas, you know, certainly absent carbon capture, and then you need to think about the prices for carbon capture. So certainly our view is that you absolutely have to understand a transition context. And, you know, we know that more than anyone because we're a South African firm. And South Africa is a country that is kind of unique in having both a huge amount of physical and transition risk. And the West have to be patient, in our view, with emerging markets as they transition. You need to work with those countries to give them technology support, to potentially have development banks help finance, because, of course, cost of capital really matters for renewable energy, which means it'll be more expensive in developing countries with higher interest rates than developed countries, where mostly we have negative or very low interest rates. So those are important transition issues. But do we need a separate framework for transition finance? I'm not sure we do.
Thank you very much. We also see this in transition-related products such as transition bonds coming to market, which is another interesting area. Finally, on a related point to the low carbon transition, how do you view nuclear energy? Do you think that nuclear energy has a place in the transition?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, this is something that we've always taken a stance on, which is that from a decarbonisation perspective, shutting down existing operating nuclear power plants is a really bad thing to do. That is going to absolutely increase emissions. So a policy, a sort of zero tolerance for nuclear, to us makes absolutely no sense within an environmental fund. We understand that there are other environmental impacts such as nuclear waste that need to be thought about, and those plants need to be operated well and safely. And that's a separate topic. You then think about nuclear new build. And where we are today is that because of the huge technological progress on renewable energy, nuclear is just very expensive. We obviously see that in the UK with, you know, Hinkley Point coming in, you know, sort of twice the cost of new offshore wind. You see it in the US, one of the utilities in Carolina filed for bankruptcy as a result of huge cost overruns on a nuclear power plant, which they decided not to finish because it was going to be too expensive. I think nuclear as a big component of getting to a zero carbon electricity grid, certainly in Europe and North America, just looks much less likely because of the progress that's been made with renewable energy, potentially the future progress with batteries and hydrogen. if you look to other regions in China, for example, I think nuclear new build is still an important part of their low carbon energy mix. They have their own domestic reactor, which is potentially lower cost. And I think different countries will make different choices. It depends a bit on land availability. So there's certain parts of China where it's very crowded and nuclear is a natural choice for those regions. And then there's technology development in terms of new, cheaper modular reactors, which we monitor. We don't see anything that changes our outlook in the very short term. But I think it's really important to understand that there are multiple, you know, people often think there's a 4-degree scenario in terms of the energy mix and a 2-degree scenario. Whereas the answer is, of course, there are hundreds and hundreds of different 2-degree scenarios. And technology development and regulatory support may well put you on one of those paths. And in terms of thinking about the direction of nuclear, the regulatory support is a very important element. It's very difficult to see, just because of the safety issues, because of the size of the projects, nuclear will have to happen because governments or regulators decide that they want to have it in the generation mix, not just only because of technology development.
As you mentioned, of course, this transition and energy mix will vary country to country. Just very quickly, I was interested to touch upon, you mentioned 2 degrees, and I was wondering why you're using 2 degrees as opposed to 1.5 degree scenarios.
To be honest, the truth is, I think where we are today is it's extraordinarily difficult to get to 1.5 degrees. You know, we're already at a degree or so of warming, but you're right to pick me up on it. I would still have some hope that that's possible. I think there's lots of, you know, the last IPCC report really illustrated incredibly well how much more, you know, the benefit of 1.5 versus 2 degrees on global ecosystems. So, you know, I would hope we get there, but it's certainly not an easy task.
Thanks very much. Finally, I thought it'd be interesting to touch upon gender equality. And as I'm sure you're aware, in the asset management space, female fund managers like yourself, sadly, still relatively rare. I was wondering what your thoughts were on the topic of gender lens investing.
Look, I think gender equality is a topic that is obviously very close to my own heart. I would totally agree with you that there's an absolute dearth of women in particularly the investment management side of the asset management industry. So if you look at the numbers for the industry, it looks more diverse than it really is, because there's a typically most firms you'll find there's a lot more female representation in the client group, in the operations, finance, than there is on the investment decision-making side. And that absolutely has to change. So I'm on the advisory board of a US organization called Girls Who Invest, who have illustrated that less than 10% of the world's investable capital is run by women, and that that is something that we should not be comfortable with. You know, the people who make those investment decisions wield a significant amount of power, and they should be more representative. So I would encourage all of the young women listening to think about a career in investment management. I think it can be a really fulfilling career. I think it can have, in a small way, a positive impact. And it's just a fascinating job to think about the evolution of sectors and companies over time and allocate capital to those that you think are doing a good job. In terms of gender lens investing specifically, I think our view would probably be that every investor should think about diversity, not just gender, but diversity across a number of different metrics when they invest with companies and engage with those companies, and that companies who do a better job with building diverse teams, that will absolutely make those organizations more resilient in times of crisis.
Thank you so much. Definitely very topical and interesting points. As you say, diversity in general should be a focus point of investors. I just also wanted to touch upon the fact that it does seem that relatively there is a significantly greater amount of female thought leadership in the sustainable finance investment space. Why do you think that this is important here?
You know, it's interesting. I think it's possibly that young women, and I see this in the people I talk to, are potentially, and I hate saying this because I don't want to in any way disencourage young men, but, you know, are more focused on building a career where they can have a positive impact. And therefore, the women who end up in sustainability, in investment management, have gone there by choice. They really care about the topic. Possibly also because it's been a very sort of niche area for a very long time. So it was an easy one to find yourself a slot. I don't know. It's a great question. But I think, you know, as we move forward, we need women across the entire spectrum. And I think sustainability moves from being, you know, we talked to some of our ultimate investors about this. Is your sustainability in a separate bucket that is, you know, a sort of niche allocation, or is it in your core asset allocation? And I think over time, it's definitely moving to the core.
Finally, just as a couple of concluding questions, you touched on this already briefly, but if we had any listeners interested in a career in sustainable investing or indeed just the wider asset management sector, what steps would you suggest that they take?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I think in the first instance, if you're interested in working in asset management, it's all about reading and learning about companies and industries. So the more that you do, with an idea of the valuation lens, is a company that I think I should allocate capital to at this price, then I think that's a great way to get started. In terms of sustainability, I think it's the same. I think there's amazing classes, obviously, at Imperial, focused on climate and focused on sustainable investing in general. It's a really new topic. So it's one where I think you have the ability to set the agenda more. The process for investing in quality companies is pretty well understood. The process for investing in sustainable companies is not well understood at all. And there's many different ways to go about it. And I've talked to you a bit about how we go about it. But I think that's what makes it such an exciting field, is that the people who join it today have the ability to set the agenda for the future.
Thanks so much. I'm sure our listeners will appreciate those insights. Just finally, if you wanted the listeners to take away one thing from this episode of IB Green Minds, what would you like it to be?
I think it's probably the first point, which is that the amount of capital that has to be invested globally to get us anywhere near 2 degrees, never mind 1.5 degrees, is phenomenal, and we have to do it now. So any small steps that you can take, whether it's buying products that are more environmentally sustainable or not buying, or thinking about, you know, your potential impact on governments or allocating capital, I think those are all hugely important and everyone has a role to play.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Deirdre, for all of your insights and thoughts today. It's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
You too. Thanks for great questions. Really enjoyed that.